Station number 17626, Mr. Thomas Lawton, Rio 10.
Mr. Lawton, Reel 10. In addition to the duties on the training side of a CSM, Company Sergeant Major, did you have other duties as well within the company? Did you have to ensure, for example, supplies, ammunition, this kind of
thing? No. That belonged to the CQMS, Company Quartermaster Sergeant, whom some called Staff Sergeant.
Who was he at this stage?
At that time, it was Company Sergeant Major Ernie Miller, who had been a regular soldier with the Duke of Wellington's years before. He was a little martinet, but a good lad. And to give an example of what kind of man he was, in the ballroom at Chester Street, there was cloakrooms, ladies' cloakrooms, with full-length mirrors. Now, there was no one allowed in there other than me. And I was sitting in my little office one day, and I heard somebody saying, "Now pay attention, and take notes what I'm telling you. Get your hair cut before next parade, or you're on a fizzer." So I thought to myself, who the world's that? I went into the cloakroom, and CQMS Miller, if standing strictly to attention, faced himself in the mirror, and telling himself off to get a haircut. Now, that's the kind of man he was. But you see, he was a CQS, and he looked after all that side, and he was a good man, there's no doubt about it. And he was responsible for the canteen which we had for the lads to get stuff from, see. And that same man now, he lives at what we call Port Meads, and he's a doddery, he's 85 year old now, and he's a proper doddery old man. I meet him pretty often. Ernie Miller, who was also a prisoner of war.
What was the situation regarding equipment and weapons for this battalion?
Well, once again, we had, I always called them 1914-18 rifles and bayonets that long, the little shortly Enfield rifle. Equipment. We had the normal pouches, the five each side pouches, and then they introduced a box pouch for quick action with a bread gun and that. Now, when you got the order, get down, you go down as quickly as possible, break in your fall if possible, but with those box pouches on, you broke your ribs if you weren't careful. And we complained about it. We said, no, we still prefer the ordinary pouch. It cushioned you, but the box pouch didn't. And another thing, the battle dress. In the beginning, with battle dresses, there were issued steel plates. A very thin, highly polished steel plate. You could use that plate to shave through. Now, in the original battle dress, there were two huge pockets on the inside. And nobody seemed to know what those pockets were for. They were simply there to slip the steel plates in, because it was a well-known fact that the majority of wounds were caused around the chest and that. Right? I never remember those steel plates being used. And the majority of people never heard of them, but I was one of the first men around here to wear a battle dress, Corporal Ford and me. And the plates were, they'd be about maybe 4 inches wide, about 6 inches long, very thin, but very tough steel. And they just slid inside the jacket so that you had a breastplate on. Yes. And these box pouches which were issued, they were really no good. You could not, when you were told to get down, you had to get down quick, break the fall, admittedly, but When you got on with these on, you're more likely to break your ribs. And yet we had to wear them because of the Bren gun. We had to have plenty of ammunition. That.
So each man carried Bren gun ammunition?
That's right.
Although he wasn't the Bren gun.
That's right. And we were carrying the Bren gun ammunition. And we were carrying these boxes, which they were not good. But anyway, we had to persevere with them. And we went to France with them. And they were just a big nuisance.
Did you have any carriers with the company, the unit? Did you have any carriers within the battalion?
No. We had no transport. And this is an interesting thing, in so much that when we got a Gildy move in France, we had no transport. The company had every butcher's van, every coal cart, everything they could, and that's how we moved. No, we had nothing like that.
Anti-tank guns?
We had the stupid boys 0.5 anti-tank rifle, which nobody wanted to fire. They were frightened of it. And it was useless, because even if you hit a German tank square on, the bullet would just bounce off it. It might have been okay for our armoured cars, which you put your fist through, but not for a German tank. And we had one to a company. We had two Bren guns to a company, one anti-tank rifle. Nobody wanted to fire it, and it just seemed to vanish. It seemed as though it was just discarded, because they realised it was a waste of time.
What about mortars? Did you have any mortars?
We had 2-inch mortars, but no mortar bombs. We had hand grenades, no primers. And what I'm trying to say is, for instance, when we landed in France, I had to stop the civilians from handling the men's rifles. The French people look askance. They must have thought they were looking at 1914-18 men with the rifles they had. And that was the situation with us. But as we were told, we were only out there for 6 months to come back home to train as a fighting battalion. In fact, the brigade would come back.
At what point had you been put into the brigade? Were they in the brigade when you joined them?
No, you see, we were in the... Good Lord. I've slipped up on that one. The 23rd Brigade, whenever it was formed, I don't know, but it was obviously formed from the sister battalions of the original battalions. And that 23rd Brigade was really a semi-pioneer brigade, insomuch that in France we did alternative weeks or alternative days, half-hearted military training, and the other putting runways in for carp or doors.
Was it part of a division, the 23rd Brigade? Was it part of a division?
It must have been.
But you don't know the number of divisions. So you went to France, as you say, on the 23rd of April, and there was quite a send-off for you going.
Oh, yes.
Very badly equipped.
Yes.
And with just pioneering work ahead
yes.
of you.
But you see, we were in the rearward areas. Frivon, Duncan, these places, rearward areas.
Before we come to that, where did you leave from? Obviously from Dunham, but where did you sail from?
Southampton. Overnight.
What's your memory of the journey?
Very quiet. No smoking on board. And of course, anything could happen before we get there. Well, it was just like a pleasure trip. And we arrived at Le Havre. That's where we disembarked.
What were your first impressions of the French?
Well, you know, I spent quite a bit time living in Belgium, and I met French people in that city, but the French people to me were always, if I say not to be trusted, that might not be the correct word. I could go into a bar and have a drink, and maybe a little patter if anybody spoke English, but there was something not genuine. When we arrived in France, they were there more or less to greet us. Lovely to see the British. But they must have said, well, they're 1914 men. Eh? nice people, but I wouldn't trust them very far or rely upon them. That's the word. Nice people, I think, but I wouldn't like to have to rely upon them a great deal. And this was carried out much later because it's unfair to say that they didn't try. Some of their armies did try very hard. And at the Dunkirk evacuation, the French were doing a lot of hard work while we were getting away. They were still trying to do it, but there was no coordination between the two. And the French command didn't seem to give the English command information as to what was happening. So it was a skirmishle.
What were your feelings about going abroad?
Well, prior to that, we were going to the Far East. And I remember coming from Durham with a colonel in a car. And I said to him, you don't look too happy, sir. He said, I'm worried. You're worried? Yes, he says, you know, we are going abroad shortly, and I've met these people before. I said, who, the Japs? No, the Germans. Well, I said, understood, we're going to the Far East. I said, well, we've even got OGs. No, he said, we're going to France. And he was in France in the 1914-18 war, and he says, I've met these people before. He was worried, not because of the people he was meeting, because of the people he was taking with him to meet them. He could appreciate, you see, that this company, this battalion, I called them the sick, the lame, and the lazy, the oddbods. Have you seen any oddbods talking about? Right?
Who was the battalion commander?
Colonel Bramwell, who was apparently in Swimmy Street a butcher, but he was a soldier. He'd been in the First World War, and he'd been with the Territorials right through from then, and they did have some idea about what was necessary.
Could you respect him? Was he a good man?
Oh yes, very good man, very good man. In so much that when I came back off that map reading course, which had been a tough course, the two young officers I came back with, when we got to Brigade HQ, they said, don't forget, Sergeant, we want some leave. We've had a tough time. Yes, sir. Want some leave. So when the RSM come out, he says, Mr. So-and-so, sir, this way, sir, please. Mr. So-and-so, this way, sir, please. When he comes by, he says, Sergeant Lawton, this way. And when I went in front of the colonel and his adjutant, the colonel looked at me like that. And he says, what have you been doing on this course? What have you been doing, sergeant, on this course? I said, I've been doing my best, sir, and that's all I can do. He looked at the adjutant, he says, we think you've been doing somebody else's best. He says, it was practically a day one, a distinguished class one. Oh. He said, we just want to congratulate you. Of course, he says, the next move is. And I had a battle dress with a pip on the shoulder. Never got it worn, never got the rank. But he said to me, congratulations, you've done very well. Now then, he says, would you like some leave? Well, I said, I would, sir. Right? He gave me 10 days leave. I lived in Burley. And when I finished my leave, I had to report to Gateshead, on the bridges at Gateshead, where there was a company there doing bridge guard. Right? So when I come out, these two young officers were there. One says, how'd you go on? I says, very well. I said, I'm going on 10 days leave. They said, what? They didn't get 1 day's leave. They soon looked at the reports, eh? And with getting the report back, they judged what they had done straight back to their companies or their battalions. Me, would you like some leave? Yes, sir. And it was right from then when I started a move. And as I say, an officer came to me And he said to me, "So, Major, I have a brand new battle dress there with a pip on the shoulder. But he says it's just a bit small for me." He says, "I'll give it to you." He says, "You might have to get the legs shortened a little bit." And I got that battle dress with a pip on the shoulder, and I had it in a suitcase. And after the war, when I came back, I went to a house in Sunderland. I'd been very friendly with a petty officer when I was down in Sunderland. I went to his house, hoping to have a quiet chat with him. Jimmy Quinn, petty officer, Royal Navy. And his wife came to the door, and she didn't recognise me after 5 years. And she called me Pat. They all called me Pat. I says, "Is he in?" She says, "Who?" I says, "Jimmy. I expect to see him sitting in the corner smoking." She says, "Jimmy went down in 1942 off the west coast of Ireland." I says, "Never, on escort business." She says, "We've still got your suitcase." And she brought the suitcase out under the cupboard, just as I'd put it there 5 years before. A couple of chest expanders in it, any amount of books on military training, and a battle dress with a pip on.
Did you have any of the good officers with the battalion when you sailed?
Oh, aye.
Do you recall any of them?
Her. You see, when we talk about Colonel Bramwell, we must also talk about Colonel Airborne and Colonel Kirkup, and these were real officers. They were gentlemen, actually. We also had the lesser man, who was obviously could be the bank clerk. He'd have a couple of flips on. Yes, there was one called Warswick, Jack Warswick. And it's funny that we call him Jack Warswick rather than Lieutenant Warswick. And I always remember his name because of Warswick Street, Newcastle. And Lieutenant Warswick, to me, was one of the nicest men you could meet. Maybe a little bit easy with the lads. Didn't have that up, see.
Was he one of your, in your company?
Oh, yes. There's quite a few.
Amongst your platoon sergeants,
I had some good platoon sergeants, including one of the heavy sides. See, there was two heavy sides. It was Michael and Norman. Norman was a little dark, proper pitman, while Michael was a taller lad, blonde head. And of the two, I think Norman would be the better soldier, but Michael was the nicest chap. Right? And it was only after a while that I said, heavy sides, Michael, heavy sides. Any relation to VC, Michael Heavysides? Yes, that's my father. See? Well, after that, we used to call them VC. Have you seen the Victoria Cross man talking about? They were good lads. And this Claude Smith, he was a good lad. I would say that I had some good sergeants in the company and good corporals. Because, you see, they had to be pretty good, else we'd never had the stripes. But they might have been they might have been the best of a bad bunch. And this was my trouble when I went to Durham. I had to really push and push and push to try and push the rubbish one side and bring out the good side. But I would say, yes, I had a rough time at Durham.
When you got into France, where did you go to on landing?
Well, when we arrived in France, we got off, formed up in battalions, and I think battalion headquarters went to a place called Bolbec. Now, the companies went to different places. Some went to Fravant, some went to Nunc. I went to a place called Grouchier-le-Valas, a lovely billet. I was billeted with an old couple in a farm cottage. They had two sons, Michael and Danielle. Danielle was 10 years old. The time came when he wouldn't go to bed until Sergeant Major Tom came in. Now the men were sleeping in the stables, see? I was sleeping there. And she got all the way, I think it was either 6 or 10 francs a week for my bed. But every morning I got a breakfast, a French breakfast without milk and, you know what I mean? She even polished me boots, polished me brasses. And when I went on a route march, Michael used to go on my shoulders, or go with us, and I'd bring him back on my shoulders. He used to show us road. Blondell, Mr. and Mrs. Blondell, Danielle and Michael Blondell. Danielle was 14, Michael was 10. And Michael and me were like pals. He wouldn't go to bed until Sergeant Major Tom came in. And many, many years later, I'd come back from Burma. I was going through some book, I come across his name, Daniel Blondell. I wrote to the address, they were still there. The last correspondence I had with Daniel, with Michael, he was a jeweler in Le Havre. Invited me across. His brother Daniel was living near Paris, invited me there. No trouble with English because his daughter-in-law was teaching English. And I had a lovely, maybe 6 weeks, living with those people and my company sleeping in the barns. I always promised to myself I would go back there, and although I've went to Brussels many a time to relatives, I never managed to get as far as Le Havre. I still think I might get there someday.
But how did the men settle in their barns?
All settled in Champion. When I say Champion, I mean Champion. The barns were clean, and the food was good, and we weren't a great deal from far from the village. And it was a real old-fashioned French farm, even the approach to it. And when you came out there, you'd walk about maybe half a mile down into the village. Well, there's a couple of pubs, a couple of establishments. And I think the men had a good time there. The most things we did there was just route march. And then, of course, we moved into the tented camp at Frevant. And that they were bell tents in line, just like a territorial camp in peacetime. They even put their beds out in the morning, lined up. And I said to Captain Muscroft, there were paper lads there, running the camp. I said, these lads know the whole story of this camp. When men would go down to the slit trenches and they read warning, they would still come along with the papers. There was overhead wire men. I said to Captain Muscroft, these men have been here too long, in my opinion. They're only overhead wire men. So what?
What was their job, a wireman?
Why, they were civvies, you know. They were working for a wire and company. They were overhead wires.
Telephones.
Like telephones, telephone lines. What we call lines, men. I said, in my opinion, they've been here too long. They've been here 4 days. And they haven't moved very far. So what? Well, I said, isn't it time somebody was asking them for some identification? We hear about fifth columnists. The paper men are running around this camp. The linesmen have been there 4 days. Oh. Eh? No, not like that. And the whole point was that camp was a good camp. The village was just down the road. And it was from the village. Some of the lads came back after having a drink. And one said to me, Sergeant Major, the women are crying down in that village. I says, crying? Yes. They're crying because the Germans are on this side of the Maginot Line. I said, don't be silly. I said, we are in the rearward areas. There are 500,000 fighting British Expeditionary Force men up there. The 6 million fighting French men up there between us and the Germans. Oh, well, they say that the Germans on this side. Little did we know that had come through the Ardennes. And when they made the move to attack neutral Belgium, our people swung round to go to their aid. And the Germans came through the Ardennes. And I read later, they were standing 7 miles of tanks nose to tail, nose right through the Ardennes back into Germany, and were depending upon one bridge, and if they couldn't get that bridge, but they did get the bridge, if we had known then, we could have smashed the whole of the German armour up. I read that later, of course, but at the time, didn't know anything.
What were you doing in Fremont?
In Fremont? One morning, we would do military training. The next morning, walking with shovels and that on the roadways, making roadways. Either alternate mornings or alternate weeks, I don't know. But that's all it was. Going for route marches, doing a little bit of arms drill, and then working as a pioneer company, putting roadways in for aircraft. And that's all we did.
Did you enjoy that task? Was it pleasant?
Well, it was, up to a point. But you see, at 4:30 a.m. on the 10th of May, I was sent to some officers and some men, and this German plane came across and put a swastika right across the blue skies of France.
That was trailing out behind it?
Eh?
Trailing out behind it, the swastika.
That's right. A cloud, you know, you put a swastika.
It was a vapour trail.
Yes. A vapour trail, we would call it, was more smoke than vapour. It was really black, and it was a perfect swastika right across northern France. And one of the officers says, that means they say this is our territory. And the reason we were there was because we'd had a gas alert. And when one of the Poland sentries had gone round and he'd checked one of the gas detector cards and he'd seen spots on there which were the same size and the same colour as liquid gas would do. But in actual fact, we realised later that the moisture from a tree dropping on there give the same result. So the question was, who was the fool that put gas detectors under trees instead of putting them in the open? So, at 4:30 that morning, they said, he's coming. That's what they said, he's coming. Little did we know that at that very time, he was attacking Belgium. He'd launched his to Belgium. See? Now then, 2 days after that, I took my company in clean fatigue, not even sidearms, down to Fremont, about a mile away, with the towels and soap to meet a mobile bath unit, which never turned up. Hardly had we got them dispersed when a dispatch rider came on a ferry motorcycle, on a ferry bike, with orders for me to get back as quickly as possible with the company to battalion. I got the battalion company rounded up, and we doubled back up there. When we got there, all sweating, orders, full marching order, as quickly as possible. We're moving out. We want to carry on. We got the full marching order, fell in, right, get on that truck, get on that, get on. So we embarked upon transport, which we didn't have. It consisted of milk wagons, dirt carts, coal carts, anything. Where we were going, nobody knew. When would we get there, nobody knew. So we travelled overnight, and in the early hours of the morning, we arrived on the Canal du Nord. Where? I couldn't tell you. Dig in. Well, my company didn't have to dig in. All I had to do was clean out all rusty rifles and rusty helmets belonging to the First World War. And we got in waiting for further orders. No further orders. When somebody said, there are troops in front of us on the other opposite bank, Sarmiger. I looked, could see the helmets moving. Who were they? Would we open fire on them and attract their fire? No, hang on. We learned later it was another company of our battalion. We didn't know they were there. They didn't know we were here. And that mobile bath unit had been in action when we went out of it. That's why they never came. And I often wondered, what did they fight the Germans with? Soap bubbles? Because the soap bubbles would be as effective as what we had to fight with.